This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Last night was a big night here in the U.S. The Democrats took the House, the Republicans held the Senate, and nobody got everything they wanted. Today, President Trump declared the midterms an almost complete victory during a long, raucous press conference. He told reporters to sit down, repeatedly complained about reporters with accents, and really got into it with CNN's Jim Acosta and NBC's Peter Alexander.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way. Go ahead.
In Jim's defense, I've traveled with him and watched him. He's a diligent reporter who busts.
Well, I'm not a big fan of yours either, so
I understand.
To be honest,
that was President Trump sounding off on Jim Acosta and then Peter Alexander. So, was this midterm election a blue wave or a red wall or a bit of both? The story is still developing, so you can get the latest updates on our website, the1a.org, and on your NPR member station. In the meantime, we'll unpack as much as we can after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Gelmar CLR. Whatever you call your home, Gelmar knows you take great pride in keeping it clean. That's where CLR comes in. CLR dissolves calcium, lime, and rust all around the house using natural ingredients, not harsh chemicals. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Keep your little piece of the planet looking its best with CLR, making the world a little cleaner.
More than 20 years. That's how long Olympic gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar abused the girls and women who came to see him for treatment. Believed, a new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR, digs into how he got away with it for so long.
Joining us for the discussion from NPR headquarters in Washington is Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist and former communications director for Senator Ted Cruz, who won his re-election fight. Alice, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you on this day after midterm. I hope you're surviving.
We are more than surviving. We are thriving. And we're going to have a great conversation with you and also with Terry McAuliffe, who's here in studio with us. He's the former governor of Virginia, governed as a Democrat, and was chairman of Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. Governor McAuliffe, welcome.
Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
And also joining us from WDET Public Radio in Detroit is Ested Herndon, national politics reporter for The New York Times. Ested, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with you, Ested Herndon. Who won yesterday? Which party came out as the big winner, if there was one?
I think it's hard to kind of declare one singular winner. I mean, Democrats will take heart in the gains that they made in the House. Some of those seats came from places where the president won, and there was a clear repudiation of this administration. But you also have to say that Republicans deepened the red wall, as if you would like to call it, especially in some of those statewide races. Big wins in places like Florida, places like Texas, that were thought to be maybe signs of a changing electorate, that maybe the Democrats had activated some new votes that would permanently alter the electoral map. We didn't quite see that happen last night. So I would say it's less of a sea change than we thought it would be, but still meaningful.
Governor McAuliffe, Democrats were predicting, hoping for, praying for a blue wave this time, a solid, loud statement to kind of repudiate Trumpism, for lack of a better word. How high was that blue wave?
Well, I've been saying for several months on TV and radio that if the Democrats pick up the House and a significant number of governorships, it will have been a great night. We won the House. Looks like 28 seats in the House. But what I'm most excited about is the governorships. We netted 7 new governors in the Midwest, huge strength for us. Women, you look at our 4 women candidate governor candidates won. So we won the governorships. Big states, as you look at Maine and Michigan and Illinois, Wisconsin was a big win for us, Nevada, New Mexico. And Laura Kelly won in Kansas. I love the governors in the sense that they will be in the chairs in 2021 when redistricting comes around. We got crushed as a party in 2011 redistricting, and many of the seats to win the House this time were those gerrymandered seats. So we'll be able to stop that from the 21 to 31. And we picked up 6 state chambers. So winning the House, winning a bunch of significant governorships, picking up a bunch of state houses, 6 state houses, a very good night, something I'm very happy with.
Alice Stewart, what about on the Republican side? Republicans lost control of the House but fended off some tough challengers in a number of ways. Was it an effective red wall that Republicans built for yesterday?
I think so. I think the fact we picked up some strong, necessary seats in the Senate was a good sign. And none of us here need to be reminded that history is generally not kind to the party in power. So it was anticipated that we would lose the House to Democrat control. But I think that's part of the process, to have checks and balances. In this current cycle, I think there was a few factors that went into the way the House played out, is history, as well as the retirements we have of many Republicans, opened up some seats for Democrat pickups, and fundraising. Democrats were very strong on fundraising, which was beneficial to them. And if I can follow up on what Governor McAuliffe said, that I do think these governor's races kind of get lost in the shuffle in the debate in Washington, and they're so, so critical in shaping of how these states play out, and just showing the strength of, you know, Republicans or Democrats in these states. And I have always felt that redistricting is kind of like the word you don't want to hear in elections, just like when I was arguing Supreme Court throughout all the presidential campaigns I've been at. You don't realize how important it is while the election is going on,
right.
until you're slapped in the face with it. Now, Supreme Court is a big deal, and in 2020, redistricting will be a huge deal, and having more Republicans or Democrats in those governor's races will be helpful.
I should note, by the way, we've had a lot of conversations on this program about gerrymandering and redistricting. You'll find those on our website, the1a.org. We should also talk about the impact of President Trump. He was not on the ballot, but he very much played a role in the races. Some of the candidates said that this was a lot about sending a message to the president about his political rhetoric. The president eventually embraced that and said, sure, let's make this about me. Presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway was on Fox and Friends this morning. Here's what she said about the impact of President Trump.
And there are a number of candidates who seemed allergic to the president on the Republican side. They didn't want him to campaign for them. They lost last night. You had people like Claire McCaskill pretending that she works with the president, saying, I'm not, quote, one of those crazy Democrats. Mm-hmm. She also this morning is not even one of those elected Democrats. So without the president's engagement on the ground, 53 rallies since he took office, 30 just in the last 2 months since Labor Day, an intensive 6-day swing leading up to Election Day, all the time being president at the same time, with historic gains. That last day alone, the three people he went and campaigned for, Mike DeWine for governor of Ohio, Mike Braun, senator now from Indiana, Josh Hawley in Missouri, huge pickups, particularly in those two Senate seats, those flipped from Democrat to Republican, on the strength of the president showing up to packed houses, historic rallies, and overflow crowds.
Kellyanne.
There's just no substitute for his engagement.
Kellyanne Conway this morning on Fox and Friends on the Fox News Channel. Estelle Herndon, how much was this midterm election a referendum on President Trump?
It was significantly, and I think she has a point there, especially in those statewide races. When we talk about those Senate races, those governorships in places that the president won in 2016, you did see a significant boost to his voter base that flowed to those Republican candidates. People like Ron DeSantis, who fashioned themselves as just basically mini Trumps, people who really hugged the president, like in Missouri and in Indiana, really, really did see a boost. And I think the White House is going to take credit for that. And they have the numbers to kind of prove that. But you also see places flipping on the other side in House districts that, frankly, Democrats should have no business competing in. You saw a significant backlash to that in places like Illinois 14 and the Illinois suburbs and more rural areas. You had Lauren Underwood come and beat Randy Holgren in a district that backed Trump significantly in 2016. And so the president's advisors, Kellyanne Conway, are saying that that's because those candidates did not have Trump there. But it really is because those districts, those voters there, have not warmed to the president's rhetoric. And we've seen that the nativist, immigration-heavy rhetoric of the last couple weeks really soured him in some of those suburbs.
Yeah, Alice, that was one of the things that came up in the days before the election, where you had House Speaker Paul Ryan saying, talk more about the economy, give up immigration, stop talking about immigration. And yet you have a number of Republicans who hewed very close to the president's line, or maybe came to support the president's more, including Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee, who is now moving up from the House to the Senate. How do you read that in terms of the Republicans who did or did not embrace the president on their campaign trails?
It's one lesson 1A in this presidency is, if you want to get the president to not talk about something, tell him not to talk about it. And he ends up will talk about it. So I think the more people said stay away from immigration in the caravan, the more he wanted to talk about it, because it resonated with his base. It energized them. He knew that immigration and securing the border and keeping illegal immigrants out of their country and encouraging people to come into this country lawfully was something that resonated with his base. And he viewed that as a key factor in why he got elected. And in his mind, that was a good way to keep his base energized and get them turned out in the polls. And that's why he focused on that at these rallies. And keep in mind, that was one of the many issues he honed on at these rallies. He did talk about that. It did seem to get picked up a little bit more in the national press. He also touted his success on the economy, the unemployment rate at historic lows, the labor participation rate at a good pace, as well as the efforts that he has made with regard to the opioid crisis. So those are the factors he discussed, and also reminding voters at his rallies that a vote for the Democrat in these races is a vote for more of Pelosi and Schumer policies. And that is something, while people on the sidelines and even some of his advisors would have preferred him to discuss his economic success, in his mind, he knew that immigration was a key motivator for his voters.
Yeah, the president mentioned Nancy Pelosi in a tweet this morning. He wrote, quote, "In all fairness, Nancy Pelosi deserves to be chosen Speaker of the House by the Democrats. If they give her a hard time, perhaps we will add some Republican votes. She has earned this great honor." Glad to get to some of your comments as well. Curtis emailed, "A good day for the country. As an independent, I find it crucial to have at least two parties in power. It'll be a good check on Trump, and the Republicans will be a good check on the Democrats in the House." Governor McAuliffe, before we move on and focus on Florida, I'd love to get your thoughts on this so-called Trump effect, particularly as it related to Democrats in more conservative states. There were a number of Democrats, particularly senators, who had what looked like some tough battles ahead of them because they were in states that supported Donald Trump.
Yeah, listen, first of all, the Senate map was brutal. I think it was the hardest map for either political party ever. And we knew going in the Senate would be tough. And that's why for months I've been saying if we win the House, we pick up a bunch of governorships. That is a great night for the party. And as I say, you know, with now these new Democratic governors, these seven governors we have, 40 million more over majority of Americans are now controlled by Democratic governors. This is critical. I think as we got the election, I think he was a huge driver for our turnout. You know, he was going to get his base out, but I think he really helped turnout. You look at women, you look at young voters, record turnout this year. And I think a lot of that was because of President Trump. I think, you know, toward the end, he doubled down on fear, hate, and division, had a very hard time talking about the tax cut, because it didn't go to help working families, had a brutal time talking about health care, even though, you know, they're all coming out saying we're for protecting pre-existing conditions, and yet the Republicans voted 70 times to get rid of it and literally ran ads saying we're going to protect it, not the Democrats. So I think health care was a huge problem for them. Couldn't talk about infrastructure because there was no infrastructure. So they doubled down on, as I say, the fear, hate, and division, talking about the caravan, sending our troops down to the border, which, you know, General Dempsey, Colin Powell, and others said it was a horrible idea. I have a son in the Marines. I mean, no parent wants to see the military used for political purposes.
Right.
So I think it was those issues that actually drove our turnout. And as I say, we won control of the House with 28 seats. We picked up seven governorships. We picked up, as I say, six state chambers. I'm very proud of Virginia, my state. We picked up three members of Congress. Nobody in their wildest dreams thought that was possible. All three were women. Big wins. We beat Barbara Comstock. We beat David Bratt.
Basically, the whole Virginia House delegation from the D.C. suburbs is now all Democratic.
Yes, absolutely. And now we have a majority, first time in a long time, a majority of the congressional delegation. And yet, if you look at the votes, they always vote more Democratic. But due to gerrymandering, you know, it was very hard to win. Now we've won, now with a Democratic governor, and we're going to have a Democratic legislature, we're going to fix it.
Brandy is in Texas. Brandy emailed, "I was thrilled to take the House, but devastated at Gillum's loss," meaning Andrew Gillum, who ran as a Democrat for governor in Florida, "Abrams' lack of clear victory," Stacey Abrams, who ran for governor in Georgia as a Democrat, "and Duncan Hunter's win," Duncan Hunter, the Republican congressman in California. Brandy goes on to write, "It speaks to the incredible power of white fear and panic. Also, 18% of black women voted for DeSantis? I'm not sure I buy that." Ron DeSantis, the Republican who won the governor's race in Florida. Race was a topic that many of you brought up in your comments, including one of our listeners who tweeted, "How could America be this racist? How can an openly white supremacist like Steve King still win a seat in Congress?" And Irwin tweeted, "The big elephant in the room, race and immigration, hate on the ascendant." Estead Herndon, could you respond to that, the impact of race in the rhetoric of the election?
Yeah, I've written several stories about this over the last couple months. I mean, it is hard to deny just how central issues of race, issues of white identity and identity politics have been to this midterm elections. We all know the president and how much he loves to talk about immigration, how the caravan became so central in the last week and a half. But even before that, you had the National Republican Campaign Committee doing several ads across the country about Colin Kaepernick and standing for the anthem. People like Ted Cruz, Marsha Blackburn, Brian Kemp all really leaned in to those messages. You also had folks like Antonio Delgado up in New York 19 face ads for quote unquote being a big city rapper and not right for that district up there in upstate New York. So it's hard to deny just how central of a role that played. But I think sometimes people forget that the reason these political attacks are being made on these lines is because they have a currency. They have a political potency that that really does fuel some things.
I mean, they use this kind of rhetoric because it works.
Exactly. I mean, I've talked to voters across aisles in the last 6 months who have told me that their number one fear was this changing country, or the number one fear was maybe that there were too many immigrants and that culture was being shifted here. And those type of things we can't separate from the electoral decisions that happened last night. So I don't think it's fair to say that all of this and everyone's vote was necessarily controlled by those ideas.
Right.
But we would be foolish to say that it wasn't top of mind for many people.
Alice, could you chime in on that, just in the nature of the rhetoric and particularly the way that race factored in?
Sure. I think it's an important distinction in that when President Trump and Republicans talk about the caravan, or specifically securing the border or immigration reform, they're talking about this from a national security standpoint and even an economic standpoint. So that is the message that this president campaigned on and won on. And I worked for Ted Cruz in the presidential election, and that is an issue that he drove home as well.
Well, but Ted Cruz and Donald Trump voiced it in different ways. I mean, Ted Cruz had one line of argument about this. Donald Trump, in his very first campaign event, said they're sending crime, drugs, rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. So the rhetoric's not the same.
I agree. I will be the first one, and I've said countless times that the tone and the rhetoric and the tactics that this president uses to make his point, I would not use, and I disagree with a lot of it, but the policies I support. I support the policies of securing our border. I support his policies of ending the Democrat catch and release policies. I support his view on ending chain migration and the visa lottery and making it more of a fair and legal system of entry into this country. The way he talks about it and the way he chooses to get his message across is not how I would do it, but the policies are sound, and that is why a lot of Republicans voted for him, and we're seeing Republicans across the board continue to stand by him because they may not agree with the tone and the tactic, but the policies are sound.
We mentioned one of the candidates who hewed very close to Donald Trump was Ron DeSantis, who ran for governor in Florida as a Republican. DeSantis has won that race, and here to help us unpack that and a number of the other races in Florida is David Smiley, a political reporter for the Miami Herald. David, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Let's talk a little bit about that race. First, let's hear part of what Mr. DeSantis and Mr. Gillum said in their speeches last night.
Other than serving our nation in uniform, the opportunity to serve as the 46th governor of the great state of Florida is the greatest professional honor of my life. Thank you, the people of Florida, for your faith, your support, and your trust you have placed in me.
I sincerely regret that I couldn't bring it home for you. But I can guarantee you this, I'm not going anywhere
We're going to fight. We're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep working. We're going to keep believing. And in all of that, I believe that ultimately we will be victorious.
That last voice was Andrew Gillum, preceded by the governor-elect of Florida, Ron DeSantis. David Smiley, there was a lot baked into this race. This was one the whole country was watching very closely. How did Ron DeSantis ultimately win this election?
I think he owes a great deal of debt to Donald Trump. His campaign was floundering about a month into the general election, and DeSantis brought on Susie Wiles, a Trump aide, to run his campaign. Trump came to Florida and very aggressively campaigned for DeSantis. Whether it was the Kavanaugh hearings or Trump's decision and the beginning of his campaign around the country to rally Republicans, somewhere in that area is when, you know, I think we started to see that Republican voter enthusiasm was increasing. If you look at the results, the turnout was around 62% in the state. So it's not that Democratic voters didn't come out for their candidates, which has been the problem for that party in the past. I think due in part to Trump, Republican voters matched that enthusiasm. And in the end, they were able to push DeSantis across the finish line.
We should also talk about the Senate race in Florida. Incumbent Democrat Bill Nelson ran against Republican Rick Scott, who was the outgoing governor of Florida. Scott has claimed victory. Nelson's camp has said, you know, has told some news organizations that they're going to fight on, that this is ripe for a recount because the numbers are so close. What do we make of that race so far?
Well, it does look like it's going to go to a recount. Whether there will be enough votes to push Bill Nelson past Scott, I think is doubtable. But it does look like that's going to linger on past the certification date.
What was going on with that race? I mean, Bill Nelson has been a Florida senator for an extremely long time. He's one of these who's just kind of a reliable, kind of moderate Democrat. Rick Scott has kind of jumped to the governor's mansion. He went from being a hospital executive, poured a bunch of his own money into a campaign, became a two-term governor. What was the nature of that race?
Yeah, I mean, Bill Nelson was kind of like a generic Democrat, which is crazy because he was in the Senate for 18 years. But he just, you know, he didn't really have a message. A lot of people were hoping that Andrew Gillum would help drag him to victory and to reelection. But I think, you know, with Rick Scott, who is enormously wealthy, with his ability and what he did in pouring tens of millions of dollars into his own campaign, which also helped other Republicans like DeSantis campaign and get money from donors who didn't have to give to the Senate's race, he was just able to completely flood the TV markets with commercials for himself and against Bill Nelson. And Rick Scott has always been around that 49% area, and he, you know, I think thanks largely to his own money, was able to hit that number. There was a lot of branding of Democrats as socialists in Florida. I mean, that was a national trend, but they really went hard at it, which with Bill Nelson was pretty absurd. But I think, you know, Scott was capable and able to brand Bill Nelson better than Nelson was able to define himself after nearly two decades in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to David Smiley, political reporter for the Miami Herald. Another thing I wanted to ask you about, David, were some of the amendments that passed in Florida, several that were really very consequential, including Amendment 4, which had to do with felons being able to regain their voting rights. Amendment 4 passed, right?
Yes, it passed. It does look like there's some issues in the courts. I was looking at Danny Rivero from WLRN, who was mentioning that there could be some legal issues which might tamp down some of the consequences of Amendment 4. But there's going to be a lot of sort of Monday morning quarterbacking and analysis about how would the election have looked if the voters who appear to be eligible fairly soon to vote in the next elections would have been able to vote in this one. That may be one of the things that Democrats might feel better about after losing yet another governor's race by 1 point or so.
David Smiley, a political reporter for the Miami Herald. David, we appreciate your time, sir. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks.
Glad also to hear from some of you about the races in Florida, including this voicemail that just landed in our inbox.
My name's Armando from Miami Beach, Florida. I am a Democratic voter and voted down-ticket Democrat with the hopes of electing a Democratic governor and Democratic senator. I was really optimistic until I started to reach out to some of my friends and colleagues who are between the ages of 18 and 25. And unfortunately, just in my little small microcosm, no one planned on voting. I was able to convince two people to vote. But I think in Florida, that's where we lost it. There wasn't enough done to energize those 18 to 25-year-olds.
Armando, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Governor McAuliffe, I'd love you to react to this, particularly because as a Floridian, I've been hearing what Armando said since at least the 2000 election. Young people, people of color, like people in South Florida, these diverse pockets along the I-4 corridor in Central Florida, that this has been the story in Florida for decades. And Florida's Democrats, for some reason, like, it's never enough to carry the candidates they really want to get elected over the finish line.
Yeah. But I think as we'll look at the exit data and the actual votes, that you will see a huge influx of young voters. I think you saw it all over the country. The Amendment 4 that you just mentioned, I cannot tell you how important it is. That will enfranchise about 1.5 million new voters in Florida. This is something very personal to me. As you probably know, I did this in Virginia. I've restored more felon rights than any governor in the history of the United States of America. I was sued by the Republicans, taken to our Supreme Court. I ultimately won. And this isn't about politics. This is about giving people a second chance. You know, in 40 states, Josh, this is, it's automatic. But in the southern states, primarily, going back to Jim Crow laws, this was a way to disenfranchise voters. In fact, when I signed my order, I stood at our Capitol where in 1902, Senator Glass said, I'm putting this in to eliminate the darkie from being a political factor in Virginia. It was clear. The
said intent, that.
Absolutely said it. I read the quote, and through executive order, I brought these people in. It's not a political issue. It's about treating people with dignity and respect. What happened yesterday in Florida on Amendment 4 is gigantic, and it will be transformational for Florida votes going forward. But I think you saw a lot more young voters coming out. As I say, you know, it was a very good night. We won the House. We won a bunch of governorships. Now we got to continue on. Next year in Virginia, Josh, we'll win both chambers in Virginia. Last year, we picked up 15 House of Delegate seats, the most since 1880.
Alice, I do want to start talking about Texas for a moment. I know we have to pause shortly, but we mentioned that Ted Cruz beat Beto O'Rourke. We'll hear some from both candidates when we return, but I just wonder what you make of Ted Cruz's victory having worked for him, and also just in terms of the strength of the O'Rourke campaign.
The O'Rourke campaign was tremendously strong, not just because they had great resources. He was a good candidate. He worked hard, and he was passionate on the issues. He connected with the people, and he ran a positive campaign. Towards the end, evidently he was given some guidance to take the gloves off, but he ran a good, strong, positive campaign, promoting himself and not tearing down his opponent to the most he possibly could. And I think that's the way it should be. And Ted did the same. I'm glad to see that Ted won. He has worked extremely hard for the people of Texas, and certainly since the recent hurricanes have hit. But he stuck strong on the issues that he cares about, which is certainly Kavanaugh was very helpful to Ted in, right, in reaffirming where a lot of his support comes. Life and Second Amendment rights, as well as border security. Key issues that he has been consistent on and certainly resonated with Texans.
We'll talk more about Texas as we continue with Alice Stewart, Ested Herndon, and Terry McAuliffe. We'll also check in on California, and we'll see what all of this might mean for the future of governing the country, if we can do that. Stay close.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. Would you know if someone applied for credit using your Social Security number? If not, listen to Joe Whitchurch, head of the CreditWise app, talk about the new SSN tracker his team recently released.
While identity fraud is something everyone needs to be worried about, we want to make it easy and seamless for them to become aware of anybody attempting to use their identity without their knowledge or permission.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
Sam Sanders here. This week I'm talking to Abby Jacobson. You know her from her Comedy Central show, Broad City. We're going to talk about a solo cross-country road trip Abby took recently and why she wrote a book all about it. That is on the latest episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Let's hear a little bit more about the Texas Senate race, where Ted Cruz kept his seat against Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke. Here is some of what Senator Cruz and Mr. O'Rourke said in their speeches last night, beginning with the senator.
Tonight is a victory for all the men and women in this room and all the men and women across this state that poured your hearts, your passion, your time, your energy to rising to defend Texas.
I want to thank this amazing campaign of people, not a dime from a single PAC, all people, all the time, in every single part of Texas. All of you showing the country how you do this. I'm so proud of you guys.
Clearly, that was Beto O'Rourke in his concession speech last night, preceded by Senator Ted Cruz. Stead Herndon, what did we learn from the Texas Senate race? It was not a blowout for Ted Cruz. It was within a few points.
No, Texas is still Texas, and so the result of a Republican senator remaining or securing re-election, we should not say as a surprise, but we should say that, you know, progressives there that I have talked to, while they were excited about the Beto campaign, were still always fairly skeptical that this result could happen this year. What they were hoping for was an infrastructure to be built, that communities would be reached and activated by a state party that has not been the best over the recent years, and that really groundwork will be laid for Texas to start mobilizing Latino, African-American voters in different parts of the state that may not have been reached previously. And they're pretty excited with how this campaign turned out. The margin looks good for them, and more importantly, the infrastructure and the resources involved have created a pipeline for Texas Democrats in the future. That all being said, Ted Cruz is their enemy number one. And so the fact that he secured re-election, won't have them be too giddy. But I think still, if you listen to Texas Democrats, they think that there was a lot to like from last night.
In terms of that pipeline, Mario emailed, "I hope that the record number of young people and people of color who came out to vote realize that it's not about Beto, it's about them. The only way the political discourse in this country is going to change is if young, diverse people continue to come out and become an ever larger part of the electorate." With those of you who voted in or were watching the races in Florida, Travis tweeted, "Imagine how different results in Florida might be this morning if the over 1 million disenfranchised Florida citizens could have cast ballots yesterday." And Barry wrote on our Facebook page, "Why did Florida, with its vulnerability to climate change, elect Republicans who don't believe in climate science?" Governor McAuliffe, races like Florida and like Texas have to be heartening in a way. And I do want to move on to talk about other races, but just briefly, It's got to be heartening in a way, and it's also got to be frustrating in a way. Like, especially the Andrew Gillum race, that morning after 2020 hindsight has got to just be making Democratic strategists in Florida tear their hair out.
Well, think how Andrew Gillum feels.
Well, yeah.
Waking up today. But I agree that if you look at Florida, you look at Georgia, I mean, you know, Stacey Abrams would have been the first African-American woman in U.S. history. Andrew Gillum would have been the first African-American governor in Florida. I mean, historic, and Beto even coming as close. So I agree, we'll take a lot of solace out of it.
I should note that Stacey Abrams, as of the time of this broadcast, has not conceded that race.
Not yet.
Right.
And you got to get 50% or it goes to a runoff, and we'll see what happens there. But, you know, we have made inroads, and I agree with the earlier statement that, you know, it's building for the future. And, you know, it takes time to do it. You know, when I ran and won 5 years ago today, Republicans controlled all the statewides. When I won, we won all three statewides, all Democrats. We built a state party, and we have led a renaissance. We used to be a red state in Virginia. We're now a blue state, primarily because we did things that people want us to do. Put the politics aside for a second. You know, I went in, I inherited a gigantic deficit, turned it into a huge surplus, record amount of jobs and economic development. But listen, I leaned in on the socially progressive issues. I kept our women's clinics open. Republicans want to shut every one of them down. We had HB2 anti-gay legislation. I stopped all of that. You got to make your state open and welcoming and a huge economic engine for the new gig disruptive economy. And that's what we did. The process that we've gone through now in Florida and Texas and Georgia, we're making great inroads. And it's going to take some time. But, You know, we had a very good night last night, and now, as I say, Democratic governors will control a vast majority of the population of the United States.
We want to talk about some of the races further west, particularly in California, but first let me get to a few of your comments from Twitter. Raul tweeted, "What scares me is the 'we won' statements. 'We' is not in reference to America. It's in reference to political party. America is entering into a new era of segregation, political segregation." Nicholas tweeted, "I find myself almost more excited about some of the ballot measures that passed. Reduced criminality of marijuana and multiple states creating independent nonpartisan commissions to create congressional district maps. Both long overdue and hopefully starting a new trend." That might be a good segue, talking about independent congressional districts and laws on marijuana, to talk about California, because California had a big election last night, a reliably Democratic state, but still worth taking a look at. And to help us do that is Joe Garofoli, a senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle and the host of the podcast It's All Political. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So Gavin Newsom has basically been running for governor since he became the lieutenant governor 8 years ago. He won the race last night. How impactful will that be in terms of California's deep blue status, especially as an opponent to President Trump politically?
Well, California will remain a deep blue state, and Newsom will be sort of at the head of that. It's no secret to anybody, Joshua, you know from your time out here, that he has political aspirations beyond being governor of California. As someone told me last night, that's not the last item on his political bucket list. So he is positioning himself as the leader of the resistance. Last night, without mentioning Trump by name, he very pointedly spoke about him in his victory speech. He said, "There's a reason why California's Dream is America's leading brand, because California's Dream has always been and always will be too big to fail and too powerful to bully." He's been taking on President Trump both online, on Twitter, and they've had sort of a back and forth at their various rallies. Trump called him a clown, and Newsom responded by comparing him to a character from a Stephen King movie. So, this is look for these two to go at it over the next 2 years.
That blue wave and the red wall that we talked about earlier in the program, what did that impact look like in California, within the state? Who gained ground? Who lost ground?
Well, the Democrats targeted 7 congressional seats here in California that Hillary Clinton won 2 years ago. And they're very close. Several of them are very close. In fact, the votes are still being counted. We may not know the results for days. But it looks like 2 incumbent Republicans are in some trouble. One of them would be Dana Rohrabacher, who was a congressman from Southern California, Orange County. And another one is Steve Knight, who's a congressman from Los Angeles County. Trump today earlier said that people who followed him were the ones who won, and those who didn't were the ones who lost. That's not the case in these two. Rohrabacher was on the short list very briefly to be Secretary of State. His nickname is Putin's favorite congressman. There's no doubt about his Republican credentials. So it's a mixed bag. We're going to see some newcomers here in California on the Democratic side.
What about some of the issues that were directly impactful to Californians? There were some ballot measures and propositions that had to deal with things like rent control and funding housing for the homeless, like some issues that Californians are very hot on. And I think a lot of other Americans are dealing with the impacts of as well where they are. How did those do?
Well, there's sort of, again, a mixed bag on that. There's a statewide proposition to expand rent control. Currently, there's only 15 cities in California, among them San Francisco, Oakland, that have rent control. But the voters turned that down. It was a bit of a confusing measure because people didn't know how it would affect them. And there was also concerns that it would chill development. And what California needs more than anything is housing. There has been a dearth of housing, particularly affordable housing, being built. Even Gavin Newsom, who wants to build a ton more housing, was against this statewide ballot measure. In San Francisco, we had Proposition C, which would have raised taxes just on businesses and just on very, very big businesses. And that one passed, and it sparked this war within the tech billionaire community, a very elite group.
Billionaire versus billionaire.
Billionaire versus billionaire violence. And on the pro side was Mark Benioff, who is the CEO of Salesforce, is San Francisco's largest employer, I believe, at this point. And he said, hey, we billionaires have to pay our fair share. On the other side was Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter. And he's like, you know what? The city doesn't know what it's doing with this money that it collects already, the $300 million. This would have doubled it to $600 million. And, excuse me, he was against it. This may be, depending on, you know, the margin of victory, this may be tied up in the courts for a while. So the money will be collected but not spent, which right. will really tick everybody off.
Joe Garofoli, senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle and host of the podcast It's All Political. Joe, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Alice, could I get you to chime in on California? Republicans have really struggled in California to build new inroads. There seem to be some seats that looked like opportunities for pickups. Maybe they still could be. Californians have, many Californians, I should say, not all, have kind of doubled down on being the core of the resistance. You have Congressman Adam Schiff, who could become the new chair of the House Intelligence Committee and take that from Devin Nunes, who won his race. How do you view California going forward?
Interesting. I was speaking with some conservatives in Los Angeles this morning, and their big takeaway, certainly it was no surprise that Gavin Newsom winning the governor race. And what this does is this sets up the war of words between Gavin Newsom and the president. And I think that will be a big takeaway from what we're getting out of California, in addition to the congressional seats that Democrats picked up, because Gavin Newsom has made it his mission to run an agenda repudiating this president. And he certainly, as you just mentioned, he has higher aspirations, and he will continue to push his agenda of environmental regulations, immigration, universal health care, single-payer health care. And that, I think, will take a lot of oxygen out of the California room with regard to the national dialogue.
Although we should be clear that it's not just his agenda. A lot of Californians are all for environmental regulation and single-payer health care.
Exactly, exactly. And he is simply leading the charge, as well as a lot of the members of Congress as well. But mm-hmm. that was the takeaway in conversation with Republicans out there in California this morning. But it will be interesting to see how Schiff and others from California, if they will start to try and play ball with this president, or if they will continue as they have been and not working across the aisle. I think it's both. The responsibility lies on both sides, with the president and Republicans, as well as Democrats. But I'd like to think that this new balance of power here will help ease that mission.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that going forward as we're winding down our conversation. Let me get to a few more comments from those of you reacting to your state's elections. Kristen emailed, as a Democrat from Missouri, I am just so confused by our state. We voted for progressive ballot measures, raising the minimum wage, medical marijuana, campaign finance reform, yet they continue to vote for GOP candidates who do not support these policies. I just don't get it. Elaine emailed, how about some kudos for Michigan? We elected Democratic women as governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. Two Democratic women flipped long-held congressional seats in our suburbs, and we have the first Muslim American representative. Laura tweeted, can we be hopeful the Democrats will get to work instead of worrying about dividing the country even more? Now is the time for Nancy Pelosi to be a leader and be the voice of reason, not the voice of revenge. Astead Herndon, I love your outlook on where we go from here, particularly because we're hearing from some listeners about the lingering political tensions in our country and in their families. Here's what one listener dropped in our inbox.
Hi there, this is Tanya Lewis from Birmingham, Alabama. It's been a rough morning. Every single thing that I voted against passed. I got my hopes up with Alabama choosing Doug Jones, and I suppose that's my fault. I should have known better. But it's been very devastating, and I am the only Democrat in my family. My entire family is Republican, and I'm for lack of a better term, closeted. So this is just making it all the harder to try to let them know what I am, you know.
Tanya, thanks very much for sharing your story with us from that closet Democrat. By the way, of course, Doug Jones was the Democratic senator who beat Roy Moore for the seat that had been Jeff Sessions' seat. Astead Herndon, I know we're low on time, but where do we see this going? Do we see signs of bipartisanship? Does the divide deepen? What's it look like right now?
Yeah, I'm probably the bearer of bad news here. I don't see that divide going anywhere. I think if there's any lesson from last night, it's that parts of the country are explicitly rejecting this kind of Trumpian message, and parts of it are clinging to it more deeply. I think we see even from the president's tweets this morning that we have a long road ahead of us in terms of getting what will be a Democratic House and a Republican president who has not shown a willingness to really bend there on the same page. And I think actually more important than the politician divide is the voter divide and the actual people. And I think that's something we actually kind of under talk about, is it's not just that these politicians are more polarized because of their own kind of ambitions and opinions. It's because the bases of those two places of those two parties are splintering more further apart. So right. I don't really see it going anywhere.
Astead Herndon, national political reporter for The New York Times. Astead, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe and former chair of Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. Governor, thanks very much.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist and former communications director for Senator Ted Cruz. Thanks, Alice.
Enjoyed it, Josh. Thanks.
Our election team was led by Stephanie Collette and James Morrison. To learn more about our staff, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and thanks for voting. This is 1A.